Systemic problems require systemic solutions. You're listening to the Next System podcast, a weekly series published by the Democracy Collaborative's Next System Project. This podcast seeks to understand contemporary challenges, interrogate emerging possibilities, and begin imagining the next system. You can learn more about the Next System Project at www.thenextsystem.org. And here is your host, Adam Simpson.
You're listening to the Next System Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. Today, our guest is Jared Green, a senior research associate at the Democracy Collaborative and author of a newly released report, Community Control of Land and Housing, Exploring Strategies for Combating Displacement, Expanding Ownership, and Building Community Wealth. Jared, welcome to the Next System Podcast.
Hi, Adam. And hi, listeners.
Great. So before we begin with your report, I wanted to ask, what sparked the interest in this report? What led you to writing this report?
So as I suspect many of podcast listeners already know, the Democracy Collaborative has a history of working with anchor institutions, which are large, typically public-owned nonprofit entities like universities and health systems, to support the vision of community wealth building, a framework for community economic development that aims to create inclusive, sustainable economies built on locally rooted, broad-based ownership of place-based assets. Over time, this has led to some really promising efforts around worker cooperative development in places like Cleveland, Ohio, where the Evergreen Cooperatives are located. And more broadly, there's an ever-growing sort of ecosystem of anchor collaborative networks that explore the ways health systems and universities can leverage their operational community engagement and investment activities to support sustainable and resilient economies. Okay. I'd say, given that background, I'll cut to the chase and say that for a while, that land and housing development, particularly that which relates to the issues of creating affordable housing and stymieing the impacts of displacement in local communities, have often been overlooked, off the radar, or either neglected in this work, despite the very real and harmful impacts that even anchor institutions have played over time. And this is especially true for communities of color, where land use and housing development hasn't always been the kindest. So the report that we wrote sort of grapples with this dynamic and focuses particularly on the issue of affordable housing and sort of centers all of the issues we see around gentrification and wealth and racial inequality in this larger and longer history of displacement, including sort of exclusion, which sort of undergirds how we sort of operate as a society in this country. If nothing else, I think what's really important is that amid the groundswell of interest in anti-displacement or anti-gentrification movements and policies, efforts to address sort of affordable housing crises, I think, have to be put into this larger context. That's really the takeaway I've got from talking with practitioners and grassroots advocates and grass tops folks and groups who are all working on these issues and trying to figure out ways to adopt some of the strategies I talk about in the report, like community land trusts, land banks, resident-owned communities, and cooperatives into policy and into their work.
Great, great. So, a lot of the Democracy Collaborative, it's about quote-unquote economic democracy. And I wanted to ask, I know this paper is about democratizing different aspects of land and housing policy and procedures, but I just wanted to ask if our aim is for a more democratic land and housing system, how would you characterize our current land and housing system, and what are kind of the consequences of this system?
This is a good question. I think in the report, the way I sort of get at this is that our current system of land and housing is, we've never really grappled with the legacy of displacement, the legacy of exclusion, particularly the sort of racialized and class-based orient in which it's all been developed. Today, I think those threads, they are sort of so baked in that the average person looks at our system and the way we would characterize it as, hyper-commodified or, for the wealthy and for the rich, not benefiting broader communities in general and highly financialized. Folks, whether or not you're living in a large city or whether or not you're living in a rural area or in the suburbs, your mortgage is owned by a bank, or, a lot of the economy is owned by someone else. Our renter economy has grown dramatically, and rents and affordability has rent is sort of higher than most folks can afford it. More people are paying 30 or 50% of their income toward rent, which is beyond what is affordable for most Americans. And I would just say that folks, the current system would be one that is really set up in a way to benefit a few people, both our policies and both sort of our economy supports that. And that's sort of not what I think a lot of folks would say they envision in terms of a democratic or more, obviously democratic economy. I'll stop there.
Sure. So one tension here that I want to raise, so is between the notions of like land, which I think we want to understand as kind of a public utility. It's not something that, if it makes sense, land as a resource, and housing as kind of an individual, like more something that might be, even if it's kind of broad-based, privately owned, versus land, which seems to be, it's connected to the environment. Land is connected to a lot of different forms of resources. So I wanted to kind of raise that tension and just to talk about how you understand kind of land and housing when we're talking through this.
Right. So that's a good question. There are a lot of scholars in this field who've done a lot of work, particularly this goes back to, scholars from Henry George and mm-hmm. other folks who look at land and consider the way that it is used in terms of a locational space sense. In a recent conversation we've had with Laurie McFarland, Laurie, I believe, hits the nail on the head with respect to how he describes it. Land is locational space being this sort of fixed asset and resource that's there. You know, if you go to a community, you've got one end and another end, and that's the in between is the land you have. And that being sort of an asset that doesn't necessarily move over time, essentially is a space that belongs to community. You give it value based on what you build on the land or how you use it. Whereas housing, we can move housing, the things, the developments that are on top of land, we can move those things around. We can move businesses or organizations around and the fixtures that are on top of that and sort of address that in an economical sense in its own right. Whereas land will always be there. So the idea that you or I might own land as individuals and somehow have our own right to that land, it's something that's really just been baked into the American sort of, or European, and even just, even broader than American, into a sort of a capitalist sort of mindset, I would say. And it sort of plays on this idea that we all have a right to something that we all need and need to sort of have right. access to. And I think our current system lives in that sort of catch-22 sort of falsehood space. And, our society sort of built on it.
Right. So one issue that often arises in these conversations has to do with the type of economic development that a lot of people, whether they're policymakers, whether they're simply locally interested, that there's this notion of economic development that necessitates a type of displacement that people refer to as gentrification. Given your work on this report, can you tell us a little bit about your understanding of gentrification and how that relates to the broader system of land and housing and broader conceptions of economic development?
Sure. Gentrification is a term that was brought up in the 60s to sort of describe what was going on in London around transforming underinvested communities in London into sort of places for more of the wealthy and affluent. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of been the system that I would say has moved from like a macro level in terms of national policies to an even more local level. You see cities sort of doing it on their own now, given dynamics around the ability of the federal government to do it. When we saw the federal government do it in the 1950s and 60s, we didn't call it gentrification at the time. I think most folks would call it urban renewal. And gentrification now is just like another like stepsister or something of, I don't know why it's got to be a stepsister, but stepsister or so, or stepbrother of housing policies that reflect the national prerogative around leveraging private capital to mm-hmm. transform communities, mm-hmm. Which in turn gives up resources and depends on the ability of investors to sort of make a return on community assets.
Right.
You relate that to the broader conversation about how land is used in general. Well, if you look at the fact that the communities in those spaces, those historically underinvested communities where folks didn't want to move to, given policies of the early 20th century that moved everyone out to the suburbs, now that we see folks wanting to come back in to see the inner core of cities or even the suburbs closer to the cities, or folks leaving places where there's not a lot of sort of hot cities where you might think about the Midwest or rural communities where there's a lot of disinvestment now, just sort of the way that money and capitalism sort of drives our economy and capital drives investment in economy really speaks to the sort of, on one hand, in the urban communities or in the hot markets where folks are moving to and gentrifying communities, you see people who've been there, who've been long disinvested in, getting pushed out,
right,
away from access to resources, opportunities, to jobs, away from public transit, those kinds of things. And then the other hand, you see the lack thereof investment of capital in other sort of dynamics causing those communities to sort of flail or sort of be stifled in their own development. And so this reliance on capital, which underpins sort of gentrification in a way, really is harmful, not just in one community or the other. It's harmful as a whole, and some would argue unsustainable.
Right, right. So finally, you touched on this earlier. I wanted to give us a chance to explore it a little bit deeper. But in particular, in the American context, there's broader issues about wealth inequality. But in particular, when it comes to the racial wealth gap, you alluded to kind of the history of segregation and the broader system of white supremacy and how that's kind of the effects that's had on our land and housing system, which has of course has exacerbated disparities in land and housing. As I understand, a lot of the wealth transfers that white families pass on from generation to generation has to do, for instance, with real estate. But yeah, I wanted to give us a chance to explore that space a bit more, your understanding of how in America this one of the biggest forms of systemic oppression has played into our current land and housing structure.
Sure. It's been, I think you would say, the overwhelming form of it in terms of how we access space and opportunity. You know, in the report, we go back to the early 1800s, I think, mm-hmm, it started around 1812 or so.
Wow.
With the War of 1812, and just sort of the dynamic of from the moment that Europeans got here and started to sort of wage battles against the native communities in America, and the wars and sort of the seizures of land and the trickery that went around even negotiating the trade of land that was happening between native communities and the colonialists, and how that sort of stole land from those folks and those communities, and how in, you know, for folks who brought here as slaves, they were explicitly restricted from access to owning land at all, and then yet worked and developed it all over time. And then when, you know, the end of slavery, you see that one of the acts that the president signed, President Lincoln signed, had initially been thought to try to give former slaves some access to land, had been sort of rejected, and that sort of policy has been reversed, and some of the land that had been sort of set aside for people to sort of take up settlements on was given back to owners who were themselves colonialists or slave owners. Then you sort of, you know, there's much more of this in the report, but then as you sort of get to the 30s, when the federal government actually steps into the housing space, what you essentially see is the federal government use race and class in sort of an implicit way to bake out an entire land and housing economy for whites to settle all across America using federal government resources, and then build up the entire middle class, mostly for white folks,
yeah,
while excluding access to homeownership for other folks. And you know, there's a great storied documentation of redlining policies and the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the discrimination that took place in there, the covenants that were used to restrict access to people from moving into certain communities or to sell their homes and land to other folks. And I also want to mention that one of the things I really wanted to touch on in the report and cared about was not just showing that the direct relationship to land in some cases, there was also just the direct relationship to being able to enter the United States. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act. There were so many other acts related to particular communities. And then the United States, like we do today, regulates who gets to come in and when, and what they can sort of do in the space. And so, you know, we've used land and housing access as a tool to, on one hand, for many generations and centuries, to restrict access to people of color and communities of color in a great deal, while essentially setting up a system for whites to sort of flourish and pass on generational wealth. And to be clear, this isn't all whites. This is, you know, obviously there's some delineation between the whites who've been able to take advantage of these policies and those who weren't. And then in the 20th century, we've seen it turn to sort of a more implicit structure, particularly post emancipation. And so even today, we see this all live out in what we talked about earlier with gentrification. We see that because land access, homeownership access, or affordable housing access has been something that is based on the ability to have capital in certain ways, and the development of communities and cities and towns and municipalities rely on that potential tax revenue that they're getting.
Right.
What's happening is that those racial gaps that are being built around land access and ownership between race and class are being perpetuated, just not so explicitly. They're being perpetuated through policy in a very subtle way. And it's leading to outcomes that we can see across race and class that sort of, you know, today that we probably weren't able to see many years ago as clearly.
Right. So let's get into the solutions aspects of your paper. So rather than starting with the different models and policy solutions that you propose, I do want to talk about the values that you emphasize in your new report and talk from there. In your paper, you emphasize, quote, strategies that can help create inclusive, participatory, and sustainable economies built on locally rooted, broad-based ownership of place-based assets. So I want to go through just a few of those, but let's think about, so leading the discussion from these values, let's start with inclusivity. Like if a policymaker or a community representative came to you and said, you know, I'm in charge of this new project, this new land and housing project, and my number one priority is a more inclusive land and housing system in my community. What kind of model do you think that you would be particularly interested in, as, or you would guide them to as someone interested in inclusivity specifically?
Well, I think in the, you know, what I would do is first follow up with that person and ask them about whether or not homeownership or building homes, homeownership is an important value, whether or not that's really an important thing for them to consider, whether they want to build a sort of culture and of ownership in that economy, and hopefully they would. Or, you know, if the community they're working with is thought to be more transient, if the culture is a little bit more transient. And I think based on those answers, and maybe it's both, based on how the answer sort of comes, you would look at different tools to sort of help support those things. And I think I make that as the first things I point out, because as we know, people are transient people. However, I think when we're talking about inclusion, we really should be clear of like what the goal of that inclusion is. I think a lot of our policies fail us because we see things like affordable housing lotteries or cooperative ownership, and even community land trust ownership in that can do rental housing, or CDFI or community development corporation based ownership of housing portfolios where they rent to people. You can see a lot of that sort of renter economy happening even with the strategies that are out there that are intended for long-term sustainability or long-term affordability in an economy. Now, if you're talking about ownership, I think that may bring about a different sort of weight to what that policymaker is looking for, and you might leverage the tools differently, which I hope, underlying what I'm saying here, I think is that you can leverage tools like community land trusts, land banks, and regional communities and cooperatives to do a mix of things. And the what's important to consider is how deep you want your resources and how long you want your resources to stretch you. I think if you say, I'm in charge of a housing development, I'm a policymaker, it's just one development, we've got a certain number of units that we're trying to create, and we're trying to build, or we're with respect to one community of single family homes, and they're trying to build home ownership, then you might be able to only stretch your resources so far if it's about ownership. If it's about rentership, you might actually be able to mix those resources to make it serve more people, let's say, but that may not get to your end goal. In terms of what model to consider, of course, I'm going to point you to the models that I've been researching, but I think what's really important in terms of the value is I just think about how we've tried to address inclusion nowadays, and that's through looking at things like inclusionary zoning and affordable housing lotteries to sort of mixing those policies together to try to make sure that a housing development or a community is open to folks of mixed incomes. A lot of these things are income-based. So when people think about inclusion, they go to what does a family make or what does an individual make, and is the housing development or is the community overall got a mix of incomes, and then does that represent inclusion? I think if you're talking about building inclusion in terms of racial and economic inclusion, again, that conversation around how homeownership and rentership really needs to happen,
right?
To figure out what resources and capacities are needed to sustain a diverse economy of folks who can own and access the opportunity to own in certain communities. And I think I would say whether or not you're looking at a community land trust, or if you're looking at a cooperative, if you're looking at or just regular, ordinary, conventional single family home ownership, what policies and how your zoning policies might influence that, I think you have to be mindful of what transparency and accountability sort of mechanisms are in place. I don't think you can't say I want a community to be diverse and inclusive, mm-hmm. and then snap your fingers and the community is diverse and inclusive. Sure. I think you can try to create the opportunities for a community to be diverse and inclusive, but what you really need to have on the back end is to try to make sure that when folks apply to be in that community, that there isn't discrimination happening in the application process. When you wait out the incomes of a community or for a particular development or for a broader community, you're not, you know, overextending the resources that you have to actually support the community. Or if you're planning it and you still have the opportunity to put a lot of resources to it, you don't short yourself on the resources to go deep. You know, one thing that comes to mind is community land trusts and the community that they've been able to serve. If we look at the data around some of the community land trusts that are out there that actually have enough data to sort of reflect what populations they're impacting, a lot of them are impacting communities somewhere along the lines of somewhere between 40 and 128% of AMI of the average, you know, median income of homes. That leaves out folks who make less than 40% of an area median income, right? And that leaves out, in a lot of cases, folks who make less than 30% of the income, and those are the folks who are the most marginalized who actually need these opportunities. So to be inclusive, I think you really have to be intentional about it. And I think what we find nowadays is that public agencies and cities and municipalities often will not commit, or either lack or don't have enough support or resources to actually bake in sort of the resources needed to make a community completely inclusive. So that ends up causing, you know, whole communities, like I just think about like Brownsville or East New York in New York, where inclusionary zoning policies that were intended to be inclusive or intended to sort of help address the problem of access to housing have come in and they built homes for certain people, but definitely not the community that's there. So, and those folks, the community that was there were folks who could barely afford, you know, what was the average rental income or what have you. They were reliant on a lot of public subsidies. And now you see solutions that are out there that are driving other people out of their communities, right, because they just aren't inclusive of them in the planning process.
Right. So does that suggest, like, even outside of structures that may come along with a community land trust or a resident-owned community or what have you, are there broader institutions in terms of, like, local, like, democratic control over communities that you think are essential to like kind of as a process in addition to land and housing? Like, it has to be like this kind of democratic aspect has to be baked in beyond land and housing is what I'm hearing, and other institutions.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think the average person would say we have our policymakers, you know, our local elected officials who do the work for us, and they're supposed to guard for these things, right? At the city level and what have you. You know, there are communities, I've seen places like in New York that have community boards for their neighborhoods, or that have community development corporations. These are institutions that were established in the 20th century, and they're still around. Some of them even own their own housing portfolio stocks. And these are sort of these community-based institutions that work not only with policymakers, but with local residents on the ground to sort of be a check or balance between the two of those the policymaking space and the advocacy that needs to happen around what the community needs and actually providing the resources. I would say what comes to mind is community benefit agreements and their ability to, they themselves, which we talk about in the report, aren't direct forms of ownership, and they themselves set up and can set up institutions or entities within themselves to help policymakers, local residents, and other community stakeholders be part of the decision making around the resources. And that's what a lot of folks in communities are advocating for now, where a developer wants to come in. Typically, the policymakers or elected officials are ready to sort of make decisions around how to allow that developer to come into that community. Mm-hmm. A lot of grassroots communities who have been saying, well, these developers are coming in and they're not providing anything that we need. Great, they're going to provide potential tax revenue, but we need housing or we need jobs. And getting those tangible demands out there in sort of a legal format that allows community to sort of steward the resources while provide in partnership with the private entity or with public entity, I think allows folks to get at that dynamic, which can often be that the folks living in communities are at odds even with their own policymakers who feel the need to sort of make change happen quickly. And often that quick change is not really the change that
right.
will be what community sort of needs or feels they need over time.
Right. So let's move on to the notion of broad-based local ownership of land and housing. How do one or many of your solutions fit in there? Can you tell us about those solutions?
I think when I think about the notion of broad-based ownership, I think the idea or the notion is that ownership is not baked in for just a few or, you know, a certain class of folks. I think it's spread across different forms of entities. And so I think underlying the strategies in our report, community land trusts, land banks, cooperatives, and community benefit agreements, is the notion that these aren't, either of them can, are going to sort of solve all the problems or be, I don't think in the next 50 years or so, right, that we're going to change our economy to just be reflective of these kinds of strategies. I think what broad-based ownership means in this context is that you have ownership that's spread across different forms of ownership and different types of ownership. So that way the economy, and you know, there's a sustainability thread here, but that way it's all not baked into some one kind of means of doing things. It's not all into banks, where banks might go under and then suddenly you've got another financial crash and then everyone suffers. I think broad-based ownership here in terms of the particular strategies could be baked into, it's, you know, it's like a two-way street. You could bake it into these models to make sure that a community land trust is diversifying how communities own their resources. So it's a nonprofit organization yeah. based as a community land trust, and then people
can,
own
can
it.
You tell us about what community land trust
yeah,
is?
Yeah. So a community land trust is a nonprofit organization that's based in a community that essentially works to achieve the goal of stewarding land and housing over time for generations. And I'm giving a very broad definition sure. there. In sort of popular sort of discourse at the moment, typically we're talking about housing, but community land trusts also can steward things like community gardens and commercial real estate. And there's some great activity out there in the space. And so when I think about the answer to the question around broad ownership there, we could be talking about broad ownership in the types of what's owned and how it's owned being stewarded by one organization. Or we could talk about the other sort of way, which is that we leverage these resources like community land trusts or cooperatives, et cetera, to create an economy that has broad ownership, where we have nonprofit ownership in community land trusts, or we have nonprofit ownership for community development corporations, or we have private ownership for folks who need it, or we have social housing in some form, and the public owns that space generally. And we have that in some ways in our economies. I just think that there's a great disparity and in how we actually resource those things. And there's also a lot of stigma and I think fear to fully support things that aren't reliant on capital in a conventional sense of the term because of how they either weren't as successful or weren't supported or had failed in the past. So to be clear, there's public housing out there now. There's community land trusts out there now. There are cooperatives out there now. People are using land banks and community benefit agreements out there in communities now. There's single family homeownership out there now. There's duplexes, townhomes, and other forms of, and condos. All these things exist in our world today. What our policies have done and what we've done as a culture and in society is privilege in sort of a conventional sense, what some might call the American dream around single family ownership. And we prioritize that so much that we have overlooked the opportunity to invest in resources that we all need as a society to rely on. And I think that's what this report gets at, is that we, these strategies that we are sort of investigating and trying to explore need to, one, be, there needs to be continued investigation to see their impact and potential impact. There also needs to be continued support for them in a way that builds them up, that we've seen them to be successful in other countries. And even in our own backyards, our universities, our health systems rely on some of the same mechanisms to steward their own housing portfolios for their own employees and direct constituencies, but they don't do it for their community broadly. And so to that point about broad ownership, we have it. I think what we don't do is speak justice to it about how it exists, and we know we don't resource them in the equitable sense of the term.
Right. So we're coming up to time, but I wanted to ask about, you have a bit in your report about like getting specific about how anchor institutions can play a more positive role in the land and housing system. Could you describe your thinking there?
Sure. And to sort of clarify or allow the listeners to know, you know, when you say a more positive role, I want to speak to the fact that what we do in the report is trace, like with other parts of the report, is just trace the role that anchor institutions have played in displacement and doing so. Again, situating what is potential with the positive into sort of what's the long history has been. And not to say that it's all been negative, but just to say that anchor institutions like hospitals, health systems, and universities and culture institutions have long had a real estate function or role in our economy. You know, and some of the more pronounced examples are urban renewal period, where our cities essentially leveraged big cultural centers and educational institutions and built them out right where there used to be huge low-income communities or communities of color, and built out these institutions in those, in place of those communities, and in the process displaced thousands of people all across the country.
Sure.
You know, there's been some change in how that dynamic works, and there's also been a lot of acceptance on the part of anchor institutions to, one, that they need to play a role in, one, building an affordable housing economy, particularly one that, to the extent that it's needed as a result of their own development and expansions. And there's a way for these institutions, particularly public ones, that get a lot of public resources to build out not only just the land, but they get, you know, dollars to help develop their own business lines from our own tax dollars. They can play a role in helping their immediate communities and the communities, you know, right after those immediate communities, to help steward resources and land in a way that makes sure that folks who need the jobs at those institutions or folks who need jobs at other institutions nearby can not only remain where they are if they're there, but also have access and opportunity to come and be there. A lot of what we see getting back to this sort of point on gentrification is that these institutions or developments come into a space, suddenly speculation leads to a lot of people selling their homes or their businesses, and private companies come in, the conglomerates come in, foreign capital comes in, the entire community changes. And before you know it, folks who were reliant on that economy being affordable end up having to move out or get pushed out because they can't afford to live there anymore. Well, what we say in the report and what we highlight is that this doesn't have to be the case. We know that anchor institutions have a lot of resources and influence in not only the policy making in their spaces, but also in their communities and what the communities look like. They can leverage not only their operational dollars, but their investment capacities, their community engagement capacities, their research capacities to support building an inclusive economy around their own existence, particularly in their host communities. Leveraging some of these strategies.
Great. And Jared, before we conclude, your report is quite comprehensive, and I'm sure, and this is a short conversation. So I wanted to ask, is there something you think is important that we haven't yet touched on that you'd want to either just raise before we conclude today?
Sure. You know, what's exciting about the report is that, you know, well, let me back up. Let me say what we wanted to do with this report is certainly not provide a silver bullet solution to, I think, the excitement and groundswell of interest in things like communal land trust and cooperative housing and things that can be done and anchor supported support for these models. All of those things are all true and they exist and they helped influence the development of this report. I think what's really important to underscore is that some of these models have been around for nearly 100 years or so. Cooperatives have been around for ages. You know, community land trusts and things like that have their roots in the 1960s in America, at least, but also have some of the things that undergird them have their roots in practices that were here before, you know, the arrival of the Europeans in America, at least. And I want to just say that while there are a couple of things that I think are the sections of our report are speaking to, a couple of things that are really important to acknowledge if you're thinking about how to leverage these strategies or ways to do this work. One is the section on displacement really is important if you're thinking about how to address affordable housing issues or gentrification issues now. Folks quickly often want to hear the solutions, and that has led us into the economy now where we have a lot of solutions or so-called solutions that are essentially perpetuating the dynamics that we have seen over time. I think really situating the moment in the broader context is really important, which is the first section of the report. In the second section, what has been really interesting in doing the research for this report is the reality that for the models that have been there over time, there's not been a lot of standardization across each cities or each model and tracing the impact of this work. So, a lot of data development has to happen in the community, and there's a lot of resources out there from institutions or even other public agencies and philanthropy that could be supporting them, but it hasn't necessarily happened yet. So I think there's an entire infrastructure question to help support these models coming to fruition. I think that needs to occur. And then lastly, you know, we speak to this in the anchor section. Again, I think not only can the anchors help support and steward these models and promote them and encourage their development, I think we can look at the anchors as case studies for how they use these models, particularly the employer assistant housing programs or other kind of programs where they are leveraging tools like ground leases to lease to homes and their faculty. These things can help inspire probably how other nonprofits can leverage those types of tools in their own space to help build out economies and communities that are inclusive and participatory and sustainable. All that together is just to say that, one, there's a long history of this work that has been done across the strategies we highlight, but also in terms of the broader context of the conversation. And in terms of moving forward, we've got institutions and capacity out there in the world to help support these things coming to sort of having a coming of age moment. And I believe that's out there, and there's a lot more work to be done. And just that, there are a lot of organizations out there like Grounded Solutions Network, Lincoln Land Institute, Policy Link, and so many others who have been doing the work of trying to move these models forward. And it's just that it is important to resource those organizations. I think it's really important to make sure we touch base with the folks on the ground who's moving the work, the folks who are actually running the land trust, and the people who are actually advocating for them, to make sure that when we try to build these models out, they are actually being built out in a way that benefits the communities that need them.
All right. Well, Jared, thank you for that. And Jared, thank you for the conversation today. And for our listeners, we'll see you next time on the Next System podcast. But while you're at thenextsystem.org, please do visit the Community Control of Land and Housing report on exploring strategies for combating displacement, expanding ownership, and building community wealth. I'm Adam Simpson. We'll see you next time on the Next System podcast.